Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. Today is Tuesday, December 16th. I'm Richard Benulli, your host, and today we have Charles Hugh Smith. Charles is author, leading global finance blogger, and America's philosopher, we call him. He's the author of several books on our economy and society, and he's written a trilogy of books the last one of which has just come out. Investing in Revolution is the name of that third book. The other two books, Mythology of Progress and Ultra Processed Life and Investing. So we'll look at those shortly and how it got progressed to the trilogy. But yeah, just want to mention that Charles has actually been his blog of twominds.com is one of CNBC's top alternative finance sites, and he also has a Substack, charleshughsmith.substack.com. Welcome, Charles.
Thank you, Richard. Well, I appreciate you giving me an opportunity to talk about the trilogy. And I think it's highly relevant to everybody as both as a worker, you know, in the global economy and as an investor in the global economy. And I think it dovetails extremely well in terms of establishing a context for your own work in assessing and dealing with geopolitical risks. And so I'm going to start by trying to describe how I progressed from in the trilogy. And so what struck me about progress was, we've been raised in an environment for decades in which progress was linked with technology, and it was considered more or less inevitable. Like things got better, things we had more comforts, more convenience, more wealth. And yet I started to see a lot of things that were not progress. You know, they were technological or financial, but they were actually anti-progress. They actually made life more difficult for us or reduced our security or reduced our health, right? So I started digging into that and I realized, well, hey, this whole thing about progress is kind of a mythology. In other words, it's a set of beliefs. It's not necessarily based on the facts of the matter, which are a little more nuanced, and there's more there. So then I started thinking, well, this whole idea of mythology is kind of like a model. And we talk about models because in systems terms, right? And we know that AI works with models, right? In other words, there's a representation of the real world that's been summarized and formalized, right? That's what AI does. So we go, okay, so progress is a model, but it's no longer working like it's supposed to. Then I started looking at everyday life, you know, like, okay, let's the mythology of progress. That's a kind of high end thinking. And you go, okay, what about daily life? And then I started looking at the way that we're obsessed or addicted to these rather unhealthy things, such as unhealthy food. Ultra processed foods now are up to like 50% of the diet of an average American, especially the youth. Then social media, which is designed to be addictive and with negative consequences, especially for teens, all of which has been heavily researched. So I wrote Ultra Processed Life to describe, like, to try to pin down what makes these things so unhealthy. And what my basic mechanism here is, what was authentic has been replaced by something that's synthetic and artificial, but it's easily controlled, highly marketed, and very profitable. So my kind of go-to example is a raw carrot is very healthy for you, but its profit is very limited, right? You can't really jack up a huge amount of profit on a raw carrot. But if you take a snack and you put a lot of cheap oils and grease in it and a lot of salt and a lot of sugar, and then you add like kind of a shred of real carrot, and then you market it as a healthy snack, you can make tons of money. And so that's kind of that's where ultra processed life has taken us. It's been profitable and easy to market, but it's been synthetic and artificial. And so we're losing our connection to the real world. then that brings me, then I, the last book, Investing in Revolution, I was thinking, okay, these two models that we're living in are breaking down. They're not sustainable. They're not stable, right? And we can look at all the problems in society and see that they're breaking down. Fertility's collapsing globally. Marriage rates are collapsing. A lot of people don't have the same opportunity in terms of employment. Even though they have college degrees, the jobs that they were hoping to get aren't there. People are loaded with debt. Governments are loaded with debt. This is not like a positive looking trajectory we're on. So then I kind of realized that if you look at civilization throughout history, you realize that a successful civilization always kind of balances economic forces, it's finance and trade and so on, with social needs. And so, in other words, society has its own kind of realm of family and community and, you know, work and so on. And yet, what we've got now is the financial economic forces are totally dominant. In other words, they dominate politics, they dominate the media, they dominate the social order. And so we see society crumbling beneath this economic machine that is functioning gloriously, right? Like the S&P 500 stocks are soaring and GDP is up and all these kind of economic statistics are saying, oh, everything's great. But society is crumbling, so something's amiss here. And so what I'm proposing, and this dovetails with your work, is we're entering a period where the global civilization, if you will, has to rebalance the economic, financial forces, technological forces with society's needs for stability and a healthy environment. And that's going to go through a period of tumultuous change while that rebalancing occurs. That's going to create a lot of risks, but it's also going to create a lot of opportunities for those investors who see beyond just the profit margin or the this quarter's earnings, and they're looking at the social consequences of their investing and deciding to invest in something with positive social outcomes, like a more stable workforce, building capital inside communities, and this kind of positive social element that we used to take for granted, that now has been lost without us really noticing. So maybe you can describe how, or at least interject how risk assessment is like a way of saying we're going to be participating in this rebalancing of economic and social forces as a positive element.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, actually, our group is developing a geopolitical risk, investment risk tool to look at public exchange traded equities from around the world. And it's very powerful. We can assess specific companies, portfolios, look at lowest risk equities. We've got predictive analytics as well. And the whole premise of this is very much aligned with your book, because we can assess certain scenarios that are happening either currently in real time, or that may happen, or that will likely happen in terms of a forecast in the near future. So we have a section on predictive analytics. We can look at capital exchange controls or nationalizations of mining companies, escalation of wars in different areas of the world. So how does all of this affect the environment there? It could be the physical environment, the political environment, and it ultimately goes up into geopolitical risk. So it allows you to assess which companies make sense as the world evolves to invest in from that perspective. So it's quite a powerful tool, and very much aligned with your thinking and how there needs to be an adaptation towards a better world, right? From given our risks and what's happening.
Yeah, and so I think that what your model could be used for is to look at what's wrong with the system, and then put your money in what's going to correct it, kind of. In other words, the what's going to rebalance things. And so the core of a positive market is always basically two things. Well, three things. One is competition, right? Without competition, you've got nothing, right? And then it's transparency. In other words, buyers and sellers have access to similar information, right? Like we know what we're buying and we know what we're, and so on. And then the other one is trust, that you can trust that the product you're buying is durable and was made well because you're paying a good price for it and so on. So without those three things, then of course the market ceases to function. And so when you have an economy like ours, which is dominated by finance in large, these huge entities, you know, big tech companies, big banking, then of course they suppress competition because they're basically cartels, and they suppress transparency because they know what's in the product and service, but we don't. And they use dynamic pricing, like they use information that they gathered from us to charge us more to maximize profits at our expense. So that, and then we're losing trust in this whole system. And as like statistically, where Americans used to trust their government in general at 80% rate, now it's 20%, like because of these dominant economic forces, they've dominated the political system. So people have lost trust. And so that's part of what happens when a model breaks down. And so I want to explain real quickly that the whole idea of model collapse, it's in the context of AI. And what happens is AI trains on its own output, right? And so that becomes self-referential. And so it starts training on what it's put into the database, and then that kind of poisons the outcomes, because and this has been well studied. You know, you can look it up online and find all kinds of studies about how that works. Well, I propose that the same thing is true of our financial system. The financial system is self-referential. It looks at GDP. Oh, it's rising. Stock market. Oh, that's rising, and it basically has poisoned its own model. And so the model's collapsing. And so I've posted some charts here.
Yeah, let's go through some of those charts.
There's one here that shows, and I'm just glancing at another screen here. So
okay. Which one?
It's called the podcast financial one.
Okay.
Where it shows net personal wealth.
Share that. Yeah. This one, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I'm proposing that the way to understand our financial system is that it's training on its own output. And so the system is veered into incoherence and hallucination, just like an AI model. The financial sector trains on its own statistics and is now hallucinating that this enormous asymmetry of wealth and income is sustainable and all is well because GDP is rising. And it's all like, well, this is a picture of an economy that's so imbalanced that is obviously going to destabilize. That's what history shows us, right?
Yeah, so exactly what history shows us.
Right, and so we're ignoring. And I'm going to look at chart two, which is the imbalanced graph of the S&P and consumer sentiment. But this self-referential system of finance, we're ignoring, and that society is crumbling beneath this supposedly wonderful financial system we have. So here's consumer sentiment, which has collapsed to levels that are basically paralleling severe recessions or you know, huge crises, and yet the S&P is at all-time highs or within a stone's throw of all-time highs. So it's like this imbalance is ignored in the financial media, and it's given just lip service, you know, politically. And that's, to me, this is evidence that the models we're using are breaking down, just like AI can break down and become incoherent and start hallucinating. The idea that progress is inevitable and all technology is positive, that model's breaking down. And then the model of financial, economic forces dominating society, that model's breaking down. And then everyday life, the model of ultra-processed life, that everything is now synthetic and artificial, and that's positive for us, that model's breaking down. So all these models are breaking down, and because they're intrinsically unhealthy and unstable, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, in systems terms. So, and we see this in another chart here I have of the bottom 50%.
Meet the Cedar Owl, a new economics and finance publication with a focus on environmentalism. We combine the Austrian School of Economics and market environmentalism principles for investing in a sustainable future. Follow the link in the description to get to know the Cedar Owl better, understand our values, our mission, exactly where we're coming from, and the type of content that we release on a cyclical basis every Thursday. Join us in targeting outperforming portfolio returns while making a positive impact on society and the environment through technology. Subscribe now for weekly insights, investment articles, and exclusive content.
Let me get that one.
This is the bottom 50% of American households' financial, their share of the financial wealth of the nation. Mm-hmm. They own 2.6%. Mm. Now, this is 170 million people. Mm-hmm. And so how can we look at this and not say that this is terribly imbalanced, you know, in terms of the distribution of the economy's output? And so, but in the financial media, this is just dismissed because we have lots of natural gas and that's going to power AI data centers and everything's going to be great. And it's all like that's actually a hallucination. It's mm-hmm. not going to be great if the system is collapsing, you know, from mm-hmm. the model is collapsing and the imbalances that are going to create disorder are expanding, right? They're not shrinking. Like there's no connection between the GDP and the SPX rising and natural gas powering data centers. That has no connection whatsoever to the, like how the bottom 50% is living, right? Mm-hmm. So that's a hallucination. And that is something that, you know, you say, wait a minute, all those statistics are real. And it's all like, well, then we go back to measuring, like, what do we measure? And we manage what we measure. So we measure GDP because it's easy, but we don't really measure the quality of life of the bottom 80% of society, right? And if mm-hmm. if we look at that, then we're going to come up with a different picture. So
hallucination is a great word because, you would think the small minority of people or institutions owning a vast amount of the wealth would become more attuned to what's going on or what could happen, because that would affect their wealth as well, right? If there's social upheaval that has happened many times in history, but they're basically hallucinating that, oh, everything is fine, we just need some more money printing.
We'll get a stable coin or a
So
the next chart I have is called it's called workers, and it's a chart that shows the decline of the share of income of the bottom 90% of workers. In other words, it's a chart that shows basically the distribution between labor and capital. Mm-hmm. And as you can see, the share that goes to labor has been declining for decades. Mm-hmm. And so what the gap between labor and capital is divisive, right? Because if wage earners can't afford a middle-class life anymore, then that destabilizes the whole system. First, it destabilizes the family and society and community, and then that will eventually bleed in and destroy the economy. So this is very reminiscent of this experiment, famous experiment done in the 60s by psychologist John Calhoun, in which he created what he called mouse utopia, which is this huge artificial world with abundant food and water and space. And then he introduced like six breeding pairs of mice, and he anticipated them breeding until they reached the population of about 6,000, which is what he estimated his artificial world would support. Well, what actually happened is when the population reached 2,200, the mice basically went insane and started exhibiting extreme antisocial behaviors, and the whole thing collapsed. And so I'm suggesting that that was very similar to what we're talking about here, where self-referential economic statistics have made us think that that this mouse utopia of finance is actually sustainable, and it's actually not. So that and mouse utopia kind of describes ultra-processed life as well. The next chart is called Capital.
Okay, and let me take that
it's, it's a chart of the distribution of income from financial assets. In other words, the gains from financial assets, from ownership of capital. And as we can see, it's an extremely asymmetric distribution, that the vast majority of the gains from ownership of financial assets goes to like the top one, you know, not just 1%, but the top 0.1%. And there's virtually none goes to the bottom 95%. And the, even the top 5%, minus that very top tier, gets relatively modest amounts of money from ownership of capital. And so again, this is a hallucination, that this is sustainable is like a hallucination generated by model collapse. That because, you know, this is not the foundation for a stable economy and society.
Right.
And so, but that's ignored. And so the last chart here is called UPL, Ultra Processed Life. And it's a chart of that shows that over half of all adult Americans are either diabetic or pre-diabetic, which is a horrendous reflection of ill health, right? This is a terrible disease, and it's of course associated with a lot of other diseases, you know, because it's related to being in extremely poor health, right? Like a very poor diet, like low nutritional value, and very a life of poor fitness. And yet this is now acceptable. This is now considered the norm, and that the model, ultra-processed life model solution here is more medications. So, and of course, those medications are all extremely profitable. But what's lacking here, of course, is why don't we return to a life that is like authentic? Like, in other words, you're eating real food, not processed food, and you're living a life that's more authentic than, and not ultra-processed social media, mass media, you know, addictive media, and also that the way that we live, it becomes returns to a more authentic way of life, as opposed to everything being digital and online and ultra processed, either digitally or processed in a factory somewhere. So you can kind of see where I'm going with this, that we as investors, both in by investing, we have to remember we're investing our time, our expertise, our skills, and our money, right? So we're investing all of those things. And what you're trying to do with your system is you're focusing on financial, you know, aspects or measurements, but what you're really doing is saying, in a broader context, hey, use your skills and your knowledge and your capital, and apply it to something where there's going to be a positive outcome, not just to you as an investor, but to the society that you're investing in. And I think that's a very powerful idea. And that's kind of where I end up my book, Investing in Revolution. We think that revolution has to be bad and disorderly and disruptive, and it collapses the, and it's like, no, actually there can be a lot of revolutions that are, you know, they progress through time, and that they have a positive result, right? And so they can be disruptive in the short term, but they can be quite positive because the system was heading towards some sort of collapse. And so you've got to have some sort of what I call social revolution, like a change in the in what we value, a change in incentives, because this is how you change the system, right? Is you change mm-hmm. the values and the incentives. Mm-hmm. And so I think what your model allows people to do is to exit the kind of casino where, you know, you're gambling with 0-day options and all this kind of like just complete gambling. And that's not going to be productive for society or the economy in the long run. And so what I see you, what you're doing as presenting options that you're investing for a longer term and you're looking with an eye on the whole context of your investment. Mm-hmm. And of course that's risk, like you want to avoid risk, but you also want to invest in something that you can, feel like you're investing in a positive revolution, not a revolution that destroys everything, but a revolution that rebalances what desperately needs to be rebalanced.
Yeah, absolutely. This tool we're developing actually ties in also to our investment philosophy, which is based on the principles of the Austrian School of Economics. And these principles have come up with a body of environmentalism called market environmentalism that we look at. And basically what that is how can you, you know, make the world better, help the world get better, but do it in a financial way, a way that makes financial sense and also economic sense in the economy. So it does it make sense overall economically, financially, and environmentally, all those three. That's what, so it's not just a lot of these green type initiatives and social elements are negative overall, either to the environment or socially. But we look at a more holistic approach, again, based on the principles of the Austrian School of Economics. And we've talked about a lot of these issues as well, these drivers that have got us to this point, Charles, in past podcasts. So the whole idea of a social revolution to help identify or correct values, make better the system that we have, right? So we talked a lot about central banking, how it's making wealth and income inequality worse by benefiting the financial sector more than other sectors, right? Because you can go to the Fed window, borrow money at a small interest rate, invest, buy a bond at a high interest rate on the same day, get free money and lever that up. So it's not fair to the Main Street, right? It's basically free money to the financial sector, things like that that really need to be addressed from a value perspective as well. And the whole idea also, we talked one podcast on representative democracy versus direct democracy. What we have had is representative democracy that has lent itself to even legalized bribery, right, with politicians aligned with companies, cartels, signing regulations that are developed by their lawyers that prevent small entrants from like educated college students from coming in, for example. You know, it's basically regulatory capture as that example. And so, you know, what are those values? We want to have a society that is fair, more just, and focus not on just financialization, right? A lot of people saying, you know, the economy, the banks are the economy. It's become, it should be the banks are enabling the economy or helping the economy. So it's totally warped, as you've pointed out, totally imbalanced. And on the food, right? Eating good food, sustainability, living, which goes back into the representative democracy, right? Large agribusinesses that have been allowed to grow food with, you know, lots of glyphosate and pesticides at the expense of the health of people. So, you know, a social revolution focused on the values can help address that. Your thoughts, Charles, on that?
Yeah, absolutely. And Richard, as you said, we've talked a lot about centralized power. In other words, when capital and power are concentrated in the hands of a few, then of course they're going to use that to their own benefit and to the expense of everyone else, right? It's kind of what I call, and many other people call, a neo-feudal system we've come to, where these huge entities, whether they're governments or corporations, have way too much power. And so, you know, if you say, well, what kind of investing can we do that's going to have a positive consequence? We could start by saying, let's put money in stuff that decentralizes power. In other words, invest in local communities, small entities that allow or enable more competition, right? As you say, new entries into a field, and more transparency. So we know what's in the food we're buying and what's in the services that we're buying. And then also trust. We have to rebuild trust that investors aren't just in to just kind of extract the maximum and then leave, right? Mm. And, you know, which is kind of the global part of the globalization story. And so the idea is that I kind of return to a more authentic model of capitalism, where the people, the investors, live in the community along with the people they're hiring and the workforce they have, and so that they're part of the community instead of just flitting around, moving money digitally in and out. And so I think that that's the foundation of a better economy and society, is to rebuild competition, transparency, and trust with our own work and effort and skills and money.
Mm-hmm. And just overall, did you want to summarize the messages of the book and the positive actions that we can take?
Okay. I think my really main point is we have to like reorder our system, if you will, and start collecting data on the entire real world that we live in, not just financial data, because that's self-referential, right? And so, and it poisons the model. And so we have to look at the entirety of the real world, which includes all these things which are sort of brushed aside, you know, which tend to be social, because those are harder to measure than financial. So we need to like rejigger what we measure and what we value. And so my idea is, let's look at the quality of life, not just GDP, because the quality of life includes financial stability, opportunity, start new businesses, the health of families and communities, and all the other elements that make a society strong and stable. That's what we need to start focusing on. So, and then in terms of incentives, we need to like rejigger the incentives away from being a casino-based economy based on banking, debt, credit, leverage, and punish basically those activities instead of rewarding them, and start rewarding long-term investing, right? And investing in communities and in production that's valuable to the whole society, not just to the investors. So that's come on to my summary. And I'm quite positive about this, because I think that my final kind of bit of thinking here is, if you lose your adaptability, then you become sclerotic and stagnant. And to some degree, by allowing finance to dominate the political and social realms, we've lost our ability to adapt in any way other than, you know, printing money, as you said. Mm-hmm. And that's not like really adaptation. That's like an expediency. And so we have to go back and say, we've got to become more agile and go back to the basics of adaptation, which is experimentation, competition, transparency, trust. These are all the elements that allow an economy and society to adapt quickly and successfully. And we're actually suppressing all of that, and we're rewarding these very destructive behaviors and incentives. So that's where I call it a social revolution. It's not a political revolution. It's a revolution in what we value, and what we're going to incentivize and what we're going to disincentivize.
That's great, great words of wisdom and a blueprint positive for society.
Yeah, thank you, Richard. I hope to be part of the positive movement here, and I think what you're doing can be an integral part for investors to become part of a positive revolution.
Yeah, thanks very much, Charlton. It was a great, insightful discussion. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Richard. I appreciate being able to talk about it.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.